Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Tonight on Standing Room Only, we'll hear from the Women's Leadership Event, which took place on March 8th of this year.
My name is Ashley Hazelrig, and I am the co-chair of the Bloomington Commission on the Status of Women. I have the great pleasure tonight of presenting the 2018 Emerging Leader Award. This award is presented to a woman in this community who has demonstrated a brief but strong commitment to women, women's issues, and women's rights. Christy Popp truly exemplifies that very commitment. As you can read from her biography in the program, she has not only built an impressive track record for helping those in need through her professional work, but she goes above and beyond for the rights of immigrants. She has been a vocal advocate for refugees, prenatal and maternity care, the rights of the homeless, and DACA recipients. All of these areas affect women and their families, and Christy's work will continue to be beneficial to those she serves. We look forward to seeing her bright future. Ladies and gentlemen, I present the City of Bloomington's 2018 Emerging Leader Award to Christy Popp.
Thank you all so much for this award. It was a complete surprise for me to learn that I had been nominated and selected for this, and I'm really honored. I don't usually think of myself as a leader, but I'm very flattered that some people think I am. 5 months ago, I gave birth to a beautiful baby girl, Ada, who's sitting back there and will hopefully stay quiet for the duration of my presentation here. Ada is not my first child, but she is my first baby girl. I also have two little boys as well. And over the last few months since her birth, I've been weighed down by the realization of what it means to raise a little girl in this society. This culture is toxic for women. Through our language, our purchases, our actions, we teach little girls to value becoming princesses over striving to be president. We talk about their beauty and compliment their looks instead of talking about their strength and intelligence. We discuss the outfits of women in power and not their accomplishments. We spend hours as women critiquing ourselves in front of mirrors, and we buy our little girls clothes that are better for sitting still and looking pretty than climbing trees and splashing in mud puddles and playing like little girls should do. As a consequence of all this, we raise little girls who believe that no matter how smart or strong or successful they become, it means nothing if they are not also beautiful. We teach them that their value lies in their looks. And as a mother to a little girl, this worries me. The entire conversation about our toxic culture and the Me Too movement is a question of power, notably the fact that we as women have very little of it. As I sat at home on my ridiculously short maternity leave, I had the chance to really reflect on all of this. And here's the thing. I know that as bad as women that look like me, who are white and educated, middle class, straight, as bad as we have had it, our sisters of color, our sisters who live in poverty, our lesbian and trans sisters, and our immigrant sisters have had it much, much worse. All women are vulnerable in a society and culture where we lack power, but the amount of power we do have as women is not evenly distributed among us. Among women in our culture, I believe that the most vulnerable is the population that I work with, the immigrant population, because if in a democracy, if our power comes from our vote, from our freedom of speech, the freedom to petition our government or run for office, then immigrant women are truly powerless. Sadly, I see the consequence of being without power or without voice. I see women whose families are being torn apart by our cruel and inhumane detention and deportation machine. I see women who are victimized first by their abusers and later by our own government. I see women who fled extreme violence and came here seeking our protection only to find themselves donning an orange jumpsuit and sitting in a private prison, and now under the Trump administration having their children ripped away from them. Our immigrant sisters are voiceless, they are powerless, and their plight is worsening under this administration. And they need us to be that voice, to use the power we have, which is our vote, to help them. I think a lot about what I want my children to grow up knowing, and it comes down to one thing for me. I want them to know that with privilege comes obligation, and I want my children to know how to use their voice and their power to ensure that no one suffers the way that we allow so many of our sisters to suffer. So I know that right now in the immigration advocacy world, it may seem like my voice is the loudest, but there are many other people who are doing great work out there. And I just want to give a shout out to a couple. Josefa, she's great. Also, to many other female advocates for immigrants here, Jane Walter, Gracia Valiant, Lillian Casillas, there's so many great women who are doing this work, and I don't do it alone. I also want to thank a few other people. I want to thank my staff, Alice, Claire, Rebecca, and Anne, because they do really great work that lets me get out there and do as much as I can to help immigrants. I want to thank my husband and my law partner, Greg Bullman. I want to thank him as well. And thank you so much for honoring me in this way. I'm really thankful.
Thank you, Christy. Next up on your program, you will see that I'm going to be giving some scholarship information, and I will be also presenting our last year's scholarship recipients. The Commission's Leadership Scholarship Initiative provides scholarships for a limited amount of women to attend conferences, workshops, and other leadership development opportunities. If you're interested in applying for a scholarship, you should go to the city's website and apply anytime during the year. It's rolling. Also, we evaluate those applications by looking for clear explanation of how the experience will shape the applicant's growth as a leader and how she will use the skills she gains to benefit the community, particularly women and girls. So tonight, you're going to hear from some of our winners from last year, and the first one I'm going to present is Megan Hutchison.
I just want to thank the commission for giving me a scholarship that helped me attend the Association of Fundraising Professionals conference last year. You know, fundraising is a really unique space that women seem to own. Women have proven ourselves to be equally successful in this field. But although we run the fundraising world, 4 out of 5 senior positions are held by men. And if you look at nonprofit boards, once a nonprofit hits $1 million budget, representation of women on that board also go dramatically down. So while we're at the table in this industry, it's still incredibly competitive. But there's hope. There's a lot of research out there that shows that for every intensive professional development that a fundraiser can get, that fundraiser can raise $37,000 more for their organization. And that is huge. That is huge for a small nonprofit like the one that I work for, Lotus Education and Arts Foundation. And I would also argue that the skills that we gain at these experiences help us be more confident to take on a senior position, help us be better fundraisers, and also credentials. At least in fundraising, there's a credential for training, so it can help you advance in your career. So thank you so much. During the conference that I attended, I was able to ask questions of lots of other female fundraisers that are more experienced than me. And I like to think that I was able to help a few beginning fundraisers myself. I was able to attend workshops throughout the conference to help me prepare for a big capital campaign that Lotus did last year. A lot of you may know, but in September of last year, Lotus started a campaign to renovate the firehouse at 4th and Rogers. It actually used to be owned by the city, but we are now renovating it, and we've had a very successful campaign, and this space is going to allow us to have a gallery space, year-round concerts, music classes with the kids at Fairview Elementary, and more. And it's been a really good privilege to connect people in Bloomington with how they want to change the world, how they want to change our Bloomington. But it's hard. There's a lot of skills that go along with fundraising. And the conference really helped me learn how to talk to people about the impact that they want to have and connect them with ways in doing that. And it also gave me the confidence to try new things. We had a very successful crowdfunding campaign that brought in more than we ever thought. And so we will be exceeding our goals for the renovation, and we are hoping to be open very soon in September of this year to open up the space to the community. And I couldn't have done that without this experience, and I couldn't have done that with all of you supporting me. So thank you so very much, and I hope to learn from you guys tonight as well.
The next recipient that I'd like to acknowledge is Katie Richards.
Thank you. I'm Katie. I work for Purdue Extension here in Monroe County, and I work as the 4-H Youth Development Extension Educator here. So I get the privilege of working with students who are kindergarten through 12th grade every day, and every day is a new experience, which is very exciting. So because of the scholarship I received, I attended the National Extension Conference on Volunteerism. So part of my job is to work with our wonderful volunteers who make our program run. Without volunteer support, 4-H wouldn't exist. We have volunteer roles that include everything from club leaders, our board is all volunteer work, and our project superintendents, and just anything else you can think of that makes an organization run. For 4-H, a volunteer does it. So through this conference, I attended several different sessions. The most that was impactful for me was a leadership session, which was all about working with volunteers to promote leadership in our students. And that session helped me see the importance of building our female students up and making sure that they know that they're supported and helping them build their confidence to assume a leadership role that maybe they otherwise wouldn't. I work a lot in the ag and STEM sectors, which we know, especially those top roles typically go to men. So it was really nice to see women taking the initiative to build confidence up in our female students to take those positions. So thank you very much. I greatly appreciate receiving the scholarship.
Now I'd like to recognize Ashley Pirani.
Good evening. As she said, my name is Ashley Pirani. I am now the president for Monroe County Now. And I received a scholarship in 2017 so that I could attend our national conference last July. At the conference, there were many opportunities to hear dynamic speakers, be a part of workshops that were chock full of invaluable information, and to talk with people from all over the country that had the same values, ideals, and things I hold true to myself. Since social justice is high on my priority list of things that I find of most interest and think are most important, those were the workshops that I gravitated towards and decided that's what I needed to focus my attention on. And one particular workshop that I would like to highlight was entitled "The Mass Incarceration of Women in America." Some of you may not know this, but women are 70% more likely than men to be incarcerated in this country. Most of those are women of color. These women are often bystanders in very low crime cases. These are nonviolent drug offenses, those sorts of things. And many of them have children as well. So as you can imagine, being a bystander, being ripped away from your children for merely being at the scene and not necessarily any involvement whatsoever, but you are guilty by association. Once incarcerated, you are then living in some pretty unimaginable conditions. Those include limited to no access to feminine hygiene products, very poor health care, and the worst of it all is if you are pregnant, there's a strong likelihood that you will also be shackled during your childbirth. Now, if you are a mother in here, or you are a father who has witnessed a woman go through childbirth, you know that that woman is not thinking about running and escaping from prison in the throes of labor. That is the last thing from her mind. So once a woman is then released, she has a difficult time finding a job. And because she has a difficult time finding a job, that means being reunited with her children becomes less and less of a likelihood. To further that, her right to vote is taken away. And to highlight a little bit of what happened in 2016, in the state of Florida, almost 3 million people, mostly people of color, were ineligible to vote because of minor offenses. And as you know, Florida was a swing state, so you can see how big of an impact that can have. Without having the opportunity to go to a conference such as this, I wouldn't have known this. I had no idea that women had such a high incarceration rate for very low offenses. So I really appreciate that I was allowed to attend this conference, and it was something I wouldn't have been able to do without the help of the commission, so I want to thank them, and I hope that some of you will take advantage of those things and also get yourself out there and get educated on some stuff. So thank you.
Last but certainly not least, Kathy Crabtree.
Hi, I'm Kathy Crabtree, and I also wanted to thank the commission for the scholarship, which helped defray the cost for me to also attend the National Organization for Women Conference with Ashley. On my scholarship application, I shared that even though I've been an advocate and an activist for social justice for over 20 years, I still have so much to learn, and every time I get involved with a new organization or attend another meeting, I find out that there's more that I don't know. And the National Now Conference was no exception. I learned so much more, even more than I'd hoped for, and I was re-energized to continue to fight for social justice for all. The conference only reinforced for me the commonality among all the issues we face: reproductive justice, economic justice, racial justice. All social justice issues are intertwined. I attended a workshop led by the Center for Reproductive Rights, which was titled Abortion Rights in the Balance: The Meaning of the Supreme Court Decision in Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt, and Our Next Steps in the Fight for Reproductive Rights. I learned that on June 27, 2016, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Center for Reproductive Rights, which essentially meant that undue burden is a meaningful standard and that facts matter. And it won't surprise you to know that many of the restrictions and regulations that Indiana has placed on women are unconstitutional. One topic that was discussed in another workshop that I attended, which was titled At the Crossroads of Economic and Reproductive Justice, they highlighted a report by the Center for American Progress called Pillars of Equity. The report highlighted five pillars: self-determination, comprehensive reproductive health access, affordability of care, parenting with dignity, which includes paid leave, flexible schedules, and freedom from violence, and workplace and caregiving support, because so many are in the sandwich generation and are taking care of both parents and children. These pillars help women to hold up half the sky. I also attended a session titled In the Criminalization of Trauma, which focused on Title IX and how this can and should be used to support girls who have been a victim of sexual violence so they can stay in school and thrive and not become part of the criminal justice system. As I said, attending the NOW conference helped re-energize me to continue to fight for social justice for all. If you want to know more about NOW, there's some information out on the table, but whether it's Monroe County NOW, Monroe County Showing Up for Racial Justice, Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense, the NAACP, Black Lives Matter, whatever organizations call out to you, just get involved. It's going to take all of us working together for social justice to make a difference. Again, I'm Kathy Crabtree, and it's my pleasure to get to introduce the speakers tonight. Our first speaker is Dr. Danielle Kilgo. Dr. Kilgo is an assistant professor, I don't know why I can't talk tonight. Dr. Kilgo is an assistant professor of journalism at the Media School at Indiana University. Her research focuses on race, gender, and disability issues in visual and digital communication. She concentrates on the international media coverage of social movements, particularly recent protests against violence and racism in the United States. She worked as a photojournalist and public relations professional prior to her academic career. Please help me welcome Dr. Danielle Kilgo.
Thanks for being here today. My name is Danielle Kilgo, and I'm new to Indiana, so bear with me a little bit. When I try to relate to the state, I'm from the South, so I would like to talk to you a little bit about what I research. What I really research are the representation of marginalized communities, and right now that research has focused primarily on grassroots social movements and protests, the national ones and the local associations. A lot of the protests that we've seen on Twitter, on Facebook, on the news, they are event-driven. Something really bad has to happen for them to have a national scope. So, for example, an unarmed black child has to die, and his shooter has to be acquitted, and we can get a national protest. An unarmed black man has to be shot by police and killed, and we can get a national protest. A sexual predator has to be identified and called out, and we can get a national protest. And the mass shooting, we can kill 17 children, and we can get a national protest. This reoccurring narrative has challenged my ability to smile on a regular basis, and so I've been obsessed with how it is portrayed in the media and how maybe we can get protests seen without having to have these really terrible things happen. So all these movements, besides the tragedy, have something else in common. And what it is that there's a person who cares. There's one singular person who cares, or maybe there's multiple people who care, but that person decides that they have a voice. They have a voice and they have a mission and they're going to act on it. They don't just care then, right? They care and they're going to act. And then that person, he talks to somebody else, or she talks to somebody else and finds out that my neighbor feels the same way, and I can make their caring action too. And so they join in, and hopefully somebody else does too. And then before you know it, we have like 12 people and we're good, right? We can go out and we can change the world. Let's fix that social issue. We all have the same message. We all have the same voice. We're all in the same place, and we go and we try to fix that issue. We're super ready. We do a small rally, a march, a demonstration, and the mainstream media, you know what they do? They ignore you completely. Now, protests need the media. Protests need the media so that they can get other people in their circle, so that they can have their demand put directly out there. And if you're ignored, then you can't get bigger. You can't spread your message. It's also very difficult to cause change. So people have quit doing that immediate rally, and they've gotten on their computers, or they've gotten on their cell phones, and they have taken their message directly to tech. And they've said, hey, I can put my message that I gave to my neighbor on the computer. And that's problematic. Because what happens when we do that is we give everybody else the ability who's not in our close circle to take the message and make it their own. So a lot of the movements we see today loses that central person who cares. And a lot of people are caring and they're talking, but maybe they're not acting. And what happens is there's a social issue, let's fix it, becomes something much more complicated. And the social issue that we're fixing has a different narrative. So maybe there's a social issue that is more important, right? Maybe there's a social issue that somebody thinks is connected with another social issue and therefore has a different message. And that's what we see a lot of time in these hashtag conversations. And when you have enough people talking about that online and you have enough people driving that decentralized message that may or may not be right, sometimes you can get 4 minutes of fame. It's not the full five, it's like four, I'll show you. So Sandra Bland died in Texas in the fall, the end of the summer, and she died in prison. Her death was skeptical. People had lots of question marks. They named a highway after her in Texas. And the police officer that was involved in her arrest, the jailing people, they're all in question. They presented evidence late. And what happened a year later was the cop was indicted for perjury. And that's about the justice that we got. So that red line that you see there, it's not stable straight. There's a little blip in it, right in July. Yeah, right in July, little bitty blip, very hard to see. That is the Say Her Name movement. The Say Her Name movement was created in addition to the Black Lives Matter movement so that we could say, we need to say her name too. This happens to black women too. This isn't just a black male issue, this is a black women issue. And not only does it happen a lot, it also goes unreported, right? They're not killing them in the streets, right? So we have this issue with the Say Her Name protest not getting any coverage. Meanwhile, you see Sandra Bland is getting quite a bit of coverage. That's the blue line that peaks. She gets coverage when she dies, and it dies pretty quickly. That second smaller hill is when the police officer was indicted. The green line is Black Lives Matter, which receives pretty stable coverage and has a decentralized message. Just so you see where that little blip is, it's 35 articles. 35 articles written about the Say Her Name movement. Social media users can change that narrative as well. We can think about them as resources when we talk about reclaiming the media. Social media users have a different agenda. This is how many times they shared those articles or interacted with those articles or engaged with those articles. That blue line to Sandra Bland, you can see after the police indictment, social media audiences cared. That was when we should have put out our hashtag. That was when we should have said, hey, we can collect on this, because we knew a bunch of people were caring. You can also see the rise in the Say Her Name hashtag just a little bit. It's picking up after justice has been served in some way. What we call movements like Say Her Name is a fringe movement. It's one that it sends on the outskirts of something, and they don't get coverage. And it plays into a larger theme of underrepresentation of women in marginalized communities. You saw this recently with the Me Too movement and Tarana Burke, who was the creator of Me Too, right? Years ago, did not have the intention of it becoming a viral movement. It was a survival space. It was a really important space, and now it is somebody else's movement, right? It is not her movement anymore. We see the same thing with Black Lives Matter, and after the school shooting, this protest was a lot about gun control, and now gun control is on the backside. Now Black Lives Matter is only about race, according to the mainstream media. This marginalization it isn't just for liberal movements. This is also for conservative movements. So anti-abortion movements receive the same sort of coverage, where they are not covered until they do something big or till something happens. That happens to be the march that they do every year, which happens in January alongside the now Women's March. The red line is the Women's March coverage. The blue line is the March for Life coverage, which is the big march that was happening in Washington, D.C. about the same time. Much less coverage for that one. It was not as big. And then just for kicks, I put in the March for Our Lives hashtag so you can see how much coverage it was originally getting right after the shooting in February. And that is the green line. This is the social media agenda. They're talking more about the anti-abortion rally. And then the women's movement is talking about for a longer time. And you can see that it was social media that helped move the March for Our Lives movement in that green peak. So what this first sort of depressing part of my research has always routinely showed is that we are voiceless. We can't amplify our voice if we didn't have one in the first place, right? We can't see it in the media. So when we do get heard, we do get to be a part of that conversation. What does it sound like, and how do we get there? And so we get heard when the network is large, and we set the stage for a demonstration-driven protest. So lots of people doing something. They have to actually do something. And they do something by engaging in marches, dramatic gestures, sit-ins, demonstrations, and they take that network and they cast it across the United States or internationally, as we've seen for the first time. And when we do that, you don't get ignored anymore. Doesn't happen. What does that look like then? It's interesting. What it looks like are three key things usually. You're riotous, you're either riotous, confrontational, or you're super dramatic. Riots associated a lot of times with black protest almost immediately. A couple of pictures you may remember from the Trump rallies as well. But even minor destruction will get covered as riot because of a pack mentality of journalists. They really like fire, right? If you set something very small on fire, they like to take pictures of it. Also with confrontation, you can have a great protest, but if one person gets arrested and they can find a video of it, it's more likely that they're gonna show them getting arrested. That's really good news, right? They're gonna make people look dramatic. The Women's March was an emotional day. They're going to cover vagina hats more than they're gonna cover the message. They're gonna find the most controversial, funny sign that they can find without finding out that this is a real thing, this has substance. For Black Lives Matter, which is normally portrayed as dangerous and confrontational, activists are portrayed as demanding. And women don't appear at all. And when they do, in Black Lives Matter movements, they are usually family members. Interesting, because black women seem to drive, most of the time, black civil rights movements. So aside from the frames, there's more. There's more ways that they will try to marginalize these movements. They'll use rhetorical strategies. They will specifically call you violent. Violent is one of these keywords that triggers people not to like the First Amendment. They'll use words that prime stereotypes as quickly as possible. And one of my favorites is they'll put words that are part of your demands into little quotation marks. They'll say like, black lives, like those are things, right? And we see this all the time. We call women silly and emotional. These are words that trigger specific ideas. You might have seen this just the other day in the Herald Times where they said this is perceived police force militarization. Now, whether or not you sit on one side of the fence or the other, the idea of putting perceived in there as if this is not a legitimate demand, first of all, it means they took a side. There's also more. They will use sourcing patterns that will privilege official narratives. And when official narratives are, there's contention between those official narratives, bystanders will be the people that they are more likely to go to. They'll go to protesters when your demands become so decentralized that they can pit them against each other in the name of objectivity. I went to show you the Black Lives Matter, how much it was driven by official narratives in the mainstream press. At Trayvon Martin, about 75% of his coverage was covered, the people that they source were officials. Michael Brown was a little bit less, at about 70. Black Lives Matter generally, a little over 60%. And just general protests at about 42. The problem with Black Lives Matter being driven by officials is that they're normally police. And this is a problem, right? This is a problem. This is part of their demands. So is there any good news? There is. I saved it for last. About 20 or 30% of the coverage will include your demands. And that is the good news. That's what I got. And they're going to try to include your advocacy preferred frames. These are the frames that come out of your centralized message. Hopefully it's not too decentralized. We're going to hope it's got some consistency with it. And then the media will select just a few of those and ignore all the others. And what did they select in Trayvon and Michael Brown coverage? They selected this 31.9% of the time that they actually covered the demands. It was about race. It was only about race. And only 10% of the time that they had coverage that included demands was this about police brutality. Trayvon Martin was not about police brutality. This was about race, right? So the media strategies, what happens is they ignore your voice, and then they give you a marginalized one. So the question is, how can we amplify our voice in this routine narrative? It's just going to keep going, and it will keep going if we don't change it. So the first thing that I think from my research that creates difference is to find events that prompt demonstrations. The killing of black lives do not stop. The rape of women does not stop. Just because one event is closed, one jurisdiction is over, one case is clarified doesn't mean there's not another one right around the corner, and I think we have to continue to find these narratives so that we can bring them up to speed. Then to create a website to centralize your message, this is pivotal and so important to have a website that will centralize the message, that cannot change. That way, if you do get decentralized, your protesters and your activists and the people who share your care, they have somewhere to go. And then seek alternative sources, become the media. We have this technological advantage over any protest ever. We can make our own media, and yes, we can actually broadcast just as hard as CNN can. Maybe not for 24 hours, unless you got some energy drinks, but you might be able to get pretty close. And I think that the biggest thing to remember is that the person that was in the middle of this message is still a person. They are not a decentralized message, they're a person, and I always advocate for self-care. So remember that the media, it does not become part of that message. When and if you get to the point where you get into the media, you will get marginalized. Get ready, right? And you will also confront counter-protesters in a way that you didn't think you were before, especially if you're engaged on social media. But the media is not your true message, change is your message, and I think that that's what you have to take going forward. So, thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kilgo, for those meaningful and very timely remarks. Our next speaker is Dr. Marisa Murray. She's an associate clinical professor of human development in the School of Public Health at Indiana University. She also serves as the director of undergraduate studies in the Department of Applied Health Sciences. Her teaching and research specializes in resiliency patterns among African American families, as well as training leaders how to cultivate and negotiate cultural competency in their respective environments. Please help me welcome Dr. Marisa Murray.
Good evening, everybody. Can you hear me? Good. I'm going to try to be very cognizant of the time by hitting start right now. I am here representing the main author of this project, who is Morgan Newman. She's studying abroad right now in France. Tough life, right? Mm-hmm. And she goes to Vanderbilt University. This is her research for the most part. I'm a co-author. Dr. Charlene Newman is in the back corner over there, and Phoebe Powell is another co-author. So I'm glad to be here. We are going to take a bit of a local slant. I was asked asked to come and present today. It was asked that I begin to share a bit of what's happening here in Bloomington. So that's what's on my mind, is what's here in Bloomington, and that Danielle was sharing what's happening more on a national front. So before I start, though, I wanted to be sure that we're all aware of a couple of presuppositions that I have. So as we talk today, when we hear about women in the media, typically rhetorically when we hear that term, we mean white women in the media. That's just the way it is, and that's fine. But we are going to talk about the intersection today of gender and race and actually age, because we're looking at high schoolers in the Bloomington area. An example of this I have up on the board. It's very wordy up there, but the main thing is when we talk about the feminist movement, we tend to mean the white feminist movement. There's a very strong black feminist movement that had to emerge because there was no room for African Americans in the feminist movement. One of the favorite slides that I shared with my graduate students last semester that evoked so much controversy was this. I don't know if a lot of people remember this from the Women's March. Yeah, very famous activist. So talk about somebody using media to their advantage. I forgot the woman's name who's holding the "Don't Forget White Women Voted for Trump" sign juxtaposed against the image of the three happy white women that are up above taking selfies with the Capitol behind them, all during the Women's March, which is a very interesting image to think about, because a lot of people don't realize that the Women's March didn't start last year or this year, but in fact about a decade ago from black women after the Black Man's March, the Million Man's March. There was a Million Women's March in Philly after that, and then 20 years later is this march, as if it just emerged on its own. So when I talk about, is it race, when we discuss, is it race plus gender, or is it gender plus race, or is it always just gender or always just race? And one thing we know is that for females in the media, that things tend to be fair. I'm sorry, things tend to be unfair and tough, but they're going to be tougher for Black women because you're adding in race. Here's the tricky part too about a presupposition that we have today before I even show you Morgan's brilliant work with her interviews of Bloomington local girls, is that Black females have a very specific and particular history in this country with regard to the media stereotypes that are born out of enslavement, and they're horrific. They range everywhere from mammy figures to dingy women to Jezebel figures to sapphire types. Sapphire is the old term for the angry Black woman. All of those things work to our disadvantage as far as portrayals in the media. But what Morgan Newman did with her work was she chose to use interviews, video interviews, to capture, which is a type of media, to capture the voices of people who are typically ignored. So let's move forward with that and look at Bloomington North High School and Bloomington South High School. Those are the students that are typically represented, not typically represented, that are mainly represented in this piece of research that was done. Only 5.1% of the students are Black in the Bloomington school systems. And the main thing is that there's a very strong concern about teacher biases because there are so few Black teachers that African-American students are likely to have. It's just not likely to happen. So there were a couple of goals, maybe more, but Morgan did all of the creating and all of the editing for this project. Phoebe Powell also did the interviews with her. Charlene and I did not do any of those. They did them on their own. I also want to take a moment. I think I need to say that Morgan graduated from Bloomington North High School. And one of the reasons why she was motivated to do this work was because of her own experiences in Bloomington North High School. So upon graduation, she came back from during the summer semester, one of her, was it her freshman semester, Charlene? I'm not sure. I don't know, somewhere around there, but she came back having graduated from the school, and she wondered, what are the experiences like for other Black girls? So simply what she did was she took a microphone out there and she said, let's find out in your own words, what's it been like for you in school? Maybe their experiences would not be anything like hers, or maybe they would mirror hers. And she also wanted to have the raw data collected in these personal interviews to enact changes among the peers, the teachers, and the administrators in the schools. Have a few minutes before we have to go to question and answers, but I just wanted to say that it takes an awful lot of courage for Morgan to conduct the research, but the young women that are in this video, can you imagine? They gave their names and they gave their schools, so it's a lot. So I'm just going to skip past a lot of this. So I wanted to just let you know very quickly, because I have exactly 2 minutes, that Morgan's research is right in line with what the National Education Association hopes to see within schools, which is that they hope to see that there are high expectations for students. What Morgan found is that often the teachers expect a lot lower standards for Black girls. They don't expect them to do that well. They also say that educators play a very essential role and that they should be trained in implicit bias and cultural competency, a number of other things. And so all of Morgan's results go right into that. I recommend this book and the interview that is right up there, Monique Morris's book called Push Out. I also like the cover of the book, which is why I put it in this presentation, because it symbolizes exactly what Morgan found a lot of times, is that Black girls are pushed out of their own childhood and out of their own childhood experiences within the classrooms within Bloomington. And I have to say that a lot of times within Bloomington, as liberal and progressive as Bloomington is and can be, a lot of times people don't believe that this could be happening in Bloomington. This could be happening in Bloomington. It's absolutely happening in Bloomington. And so Morgan took her resiliency, she took her, what she had, a tool, a microphone, and gave it to these young women. So in summary, what did the Black girls in Bloomington want? I just said, based on what Morgan's research was, to be academically respected and treated with cultural competence by their teachers. To be in a safe classroom environment like their peers, and to be allowed to include their whole selves, to be emotionally and physically valued and protected in their school environment. Just have to say real quick, in the young girl's interview, when Morgan, that was Morgan's voice in the background, by the way, prompting the questions, when Morgan said, were there adults at that game that could have helped you? She said, yeah, no, they didn't help. Nobody stepped in to say anything, and so, the girls obviously want to be protected by adults, which is what we hope to see with all children. That's a natural thing, but they're not experiencing that protection. And also to have an equal opportunity to just enjoy friendships and neighborhoods and to be a part of the local Bloomington community, but not have to be void of their ethnicity while doing so. So that's all. Right at 20 minutes. Thank you for your time.
This time we're going to have questions and answers, which will be open. If those so inclined can tweet the questions the way Lisi explained. We've also got note cards that we're going to hand out. So if you'd like to write down questions on the note cards and pass them up, that's fine too. We have an additional speaker that I want to recognize, Dr. Charlene Newman. She is with Indiana University Psychological and Brain Sciences Department. So at this time, if anyone has questions.
The question is for Dr. Kilgo. I was wondering if there was a particular time frame or sort of a key kind of tipping point to get your message recognized by the media, or basically to kind of build a social movement around a message. Like, is it a couple days or a week, or sort of what the time frame might be?
There is sometimes tipping points. It depends on if you can find the event to drive the demonstration. I think that you need that, and you have to be able to get that connection with the people who care. So there's an emotional drive, I think, that is important. And for me and the local activists that I worked with in Texas to try to just follow activist communication messages, when there was this emotional overflow is when they were most successful. And it wasn't an overflow of rage, it was an overflow of, there's so many events, we can do this now. And when it comes to social media, the tipping point that you have to look for is when not to tip. And that is usually when there is no news. So you want to find, or I'm sorry, there's usually when there's other news. You want to find the hole where there's no news, and you want to fill in that space. Because you as a small movement and you as a large movement usually cannot compete against something that has more news value. That includes tweets in the morning and car crashes that stop the highway, right?
Does anyone else have a question they'd like to share? Well, first, I was just really struck by Morgan and her work. I think that's amazing that a high school student or a recently graduated student, as you said, was brave enough to do that. And I hope that that's going to be required viewing for the teachers. I don't know if there's a way we can help make that happen, but I think that would be good for our education. Yeah, so if there's a way we can make that happen, I may get with you after. If you have ideas on how to do that, we could take it to the school board. I don't know.
I don't necessarily have ideas to do that, but I do want to just share one thing. So if you notice, the students who did mention a teacher.
Yes. Mr. Philbeck. Yes,
and he was one of Morgan's teachers. So for those who may not know, Morgan is my daughter. And so he was one of her teachers and one of her favorite teachers. And the thing that I want to really emphasize is that what Mr. Philbeck does in his class is not anything special for black students. He's not singling them out. He's not sort of putting them anywhere. He's creating a safe space in his class where he does not allow students to name call or disrespect other students. And I think that's the important point here, is that you don't single them out. These students don't want to be have a spotlight put on them.
Right.
They just want to be like everyone else. And that's what he creates in his classroom. And that's something every teacher should be able to create in their classroom.
Right.
And so whether it's viewing this video or having some training so that they learn how to create these types of spaces in their classroom, something should be done, because they're not learning it. They're not learning it in the school of education, right? So somewhere they need to be taught how to do that.
I agree. And that's, I can't remember which one of you, or maybe more than one of you, mentioned implicit bias. And I think implicit bias training should be mandatory. I've just gone through some. I'm doing some training on my own, but I think it should be mandatory for teachers, because it's not always intentional, but we do all have implicit bias, and we need to be aware of it. So like you said, we could just make everyone feel welcome in the classroom. All right, so we have a question here. The video has qualitative data, which I love, but a lot of research in the academic world requires quantitative data. How can this translate into action?
So I think I would like to disagree with the premise of that question.
Okay.
So qualitative data is equally as valuable as quantitative data. So that's the first thing I do want to just point out. While I'm definitely, in my professional life, on the quantitative side of things as a brain scientist, qualitative data is equally as valuable. So I don't want to devalue qualitative data. And again, how do we use the data that we have? And I also want to take another step back. When you take a look at the population in Bloomington, as mentioned, there are very few African American students in the classrooms. Again, Morgan is my daughter. 1 year at Benford, she was the only black kid in her grade.
Exactly.
So how do you get quantitative data when you have a situation like that, right? So it was, and my parents didn't believe me, right? So, you know, they post the mean standardized test scores online. I pulled it up, they had to leave it blank for African American, because she was the only one, and that would have been her score, right? So so you have these kinds of situations in Bloomington, right? And so, and the data that shows that teachers of color actually do a really great job with working with students, not just students of color, but students in general. Mm-hmm. So she went through the whole school system here without ever having a teacher of color. I'm from Alabama. That was not my experience, right? So my experience is completely different from her experience, and it shows in how she was raised. So how do you use this data? I mean, hiring more diverse teachers is one thing that can definitely be done. So think about hiring teachers that don't all look alike, don't all come from the same background. I mean, that could be helpful.
Yes.
I don't know if you want to add, or someone else want to add.
Well, I actually want to act like I don't know the answer to this question, but I'm going to volley back and forth with you, because you mentioned that you're from Alabama, right? And your daughter was raised here in Bloomington. And given all of these very harsh experiences that I think we'd all agree that children have been experiencing based on this raw data, your daughter has experienced being called names, right? Racial names?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Have you ever been called nigger, being a woman from Alabama?
No.
Which is very interesting, because one would think that a woman from the South, especially we from the North or the Midwest, we tend to think that the real racist people are down South, the Klan, and the Klan's right here, and many other groups are right here. But you've never been called that word.
Never growing up was I ever called that, ever.
So,
but students here are regularly called it. You can speak to any African-American student off the street and ask them if they've ever been referred to. They all have.
Yes. And so imagine a woman who had her daughter, and seeing that her daughter's experience is not one of moving forward, which most parents want to see. Oh, it's going to get better. Surely if I've not been called nigger, my daughter wouldn't be called nigger. Oh, no. She has been. And so I want to say that because of the particular environment that we find ourselves in Bloomington, because we would not really think that would be the case. And it's not. I know that it's not a horrible place, but there's room for improvement. Often we feel like there's no room for improvement in a place that's very open-minded.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that, and I echo that. I think that we in Bloomington, and this has come up recently with many of the current events that are going on, we mm-hmm. think we're special. We don't do bad things in Bloomington. When the video showed the young women talking particularly about their experiences in grade school, that's on us. That's on this society and what we're allowing and teaching our children, because children are not born racist. So, yes, I totally echo that. I wanted to ask, and I hope this is appropriate for your research, Dr. Kilgo, but the Women's March photographs made me recollect that when I went to the DC Women's March 2 years ago, and I felt very much like I was experiencing white privilege as a march, as a large group of people, because it was predominantly women, white. And, you know, there were police all over, and never did I feel threatened, never did anyone want to see what I was carrying in my backpack, and it was just kind of the perceptions and the stereotypes that you mentioned, and I don't know if you can speak to that at all, that large of a group of white people gathered as opposed to a large group of African Americans or other people of color and the way we were treated?
So the women's movement in 2017 and 2018 enjoyed fierce organization, which was nice for them. They had that website that they needed to centralize, and they had one hashtag, and they rallied around it. And I don't think that the Women's March was wholly white. There was other people there.
No.
And I think that, yes, it was super privileged. Yes, it was crazy that they could shut down highways. And I was in Austin at that time, and I went to go photograph the protesters. And shutting down 5th Street and 6th Street in Austin is kind of like a no-no, because that's where all their business comes from. They have to shut it down at night, all day long, shut down. The Capitol couldn't get around it, and that's not something that would have happened for other protests had they been that big. That was not something that would have been allowed. When black protests shut down highways, they're given felonies.
Right,
they're treated as riotous. Like your baby didn't get picked up from daycare because of these protesters. This is how this is framed in the media. And so there's clearly a different rhetoric that goes to describing what happened with the women's movement than what happened with other large movements.
Been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.